Next, we have Jerry Barracks. I just want to say, I think this festival may be slightly counterculture for Chapel Hill Carrboro, because I think we have three faculty members from NC State reading and a couple from Duke. So, and I don't think anybody from UNC is here. So anyway, the next poet I would like to introduce is Jerry Barracks. And just a little note, I think An Audience of One was the very first contemporary book of poetry I ever purchased, and I remember copying down by hand this long poem called The Cello, I think it's called, and this was many years ago, so I'm really excited to have him here, Jerry Barracks.
The voice you hear doesn't sound like my voice to me. I've been sucking on Sucrets all day to try to treat my throat. It may sound okay to you, but not to me. I told Doug Stuber after his reading this morning that I also have a poem about Jerry Falwell. I'd only intended to read three poems, but this is very short. It's a limerick, one of 10 what I called... What did I call them? Oh, dangerous limericks or something like that. Jerry Falwell. Ask if he chose to be straight. His answer, you'll wait and you'll wait. But he finds it so strange that gaze will not change. And he uses his Bible as bait. Now, please don't put your hands together until I'm finished. Okay. This poem is titled Pittsburgh, 1948, The Music Teacher. If there's anyone here from Pittsburgh, this takes place on Frankstown Avenue. I don't know where my mother got him, whose caricature he was, or how he found me to travel by streetcars on Saturday mornings to the Negro home, our two rooms and bath on the Hornsby's second floor. His name was Professor something or other Slavic, portly, florid man, bald pate surrounded by stringy gray hair. Everything about him was threadbare, wing collar, string tie, French cuffs, cutaway coat. His sausage fingers were grimy, his nails dirty. I think now he was one of the war's displaced persons who accepted with grace coming to give violin lessons to a 15-year-old alien boy. Displaced here myself from a continent, from a country I couldn't name, and a defector from Alabama. I was the debt he had to pay on the short end of a refugee's desperate wager or prayer to redeem the body before the soul. I don't know why my mother didn't give him his paltry $3. I had to do it. One morning he stood at my side, waving his bow in time to my playing, swayed once and crumpled to the kitchen floor that she had made spotless for him, taking the music stand down. I stood terrified until she ran in and we helped him to his feet. He finished my lesson in dignified shame, but I knew from pure intuition that he had not eluded the hounds of hunger. Outside of death camps, I'd seen liberated in newsreels and Life magazine. It was the first time, I think, I'd felt sorry for anyone white. The next poem I began in January of 2003, more than a year ago, had been rereading poems by Edwin Arlington Robinson, a poet I admire very much. And I was reading again about Mr. Flood and Minerva Cheevy, Richard Corey, Reuben Bright, Luke Havergal, and the tragic couple in Eros Tyrannos. These are misfits and lonely outcasts from Tilbury Town. And I thought I would try my hand at writing a character poem about several about disturbed people. And the character in this poem has a fetish or an obsession, or maybe both. Maybe he's obsessed with his fetish. I chose the name of the character very carefully to be as multicultural and multi-ethnic as possible. Francois Leroy McPherson. I have a friend, the only other person who's read this poem, and this is the first time I've read it, who had doubts about my reading it in public. She thought it would be good on the page, but reading it might make some people squirm and uncomfortable. I thought, well, damn, that's what poems are supposed to do, isn't it? So here is Francois Leroy McPherson. Francois Leroy McPherson is waiting for the tide to turn, when thongs go out and hair is in again. He cultivates nostalgia for Ava and Rita, posing in photoplay and silver screen. Their hide-all boxer swim shorts rise to navels, down to thighs, cover the pelvis and secret pubes. No bikini zones to dull the honed imagination, to wonder whether the colors are true, to dream what textures, what patterns and densities. There could be no Baywatch on the sand today, with wild curls, feathers, wool, making fringes around strips of thigh-high lycra. Victoria has left no room for secrets. The new multimedia have been defoliated, and his hands flinch and falter at Barbie's ball pudenda. Once nude jaybird families romped in sunshine and health, mothers, teen daughters, frozen in flight at volleyball nets, silhouetted, shaggy, misplaced manes, handstands, bridges, bushes growing into the sun. Candid shots caught them spread-eagled up there in every exposure he could have dreamed of. Francois Leroy McPherson still dreams through the keyhole, his breath nowhere he ever wanted it to be, and sees his mother rise, water channels down her body, funnels through, a raven and pelt, soapy stream back into the tub. He wobbles back to his room and dreams himself into his terrified prison. When he thought he was old enough to dare, he tried the casino theater, fearful he might be turned away. He sat in middle rows, an island among old men who laughed without conviction at antediluvian traveling salesmen, farmers' daughters, clowns in kaleidoscopes of mismatched costumes. They were more generous to the girl who switched herself across the stage to confront the toothless clown rummaging around inside his baggy pants. Oh, Mr. Featherstone, is that a present for me you have in your pocket? And grinding a bump that sent Featherstone reeling back across his side of the stage. They suffered the warm-up local talent, who teased more than stripped, to pasties and G-strings only. Then the brighter lights, Domei, the Indian princess, in her war bonnet, her moneymaker rouged, the better to see. And the more famous headliners, Lily St. Cyr, Tempest Storm, Sally Rand, hiding behind their reputations, and Irma the Body, Irma. He searched the post weekly, not to miss her. He moved to the front rows. Irma, her body its own seashell. When she came to that moment, he looked up into a curled sunflower, its center cleft by a vermilion orchid, and his 7 million cones exploded, blinding him, leaving only the solace of rods and their shades of gray. He wanted to weep. When he was a man, he did. In his old harem of paper dolls, there are no Barbies. He studies, examines, magnifies, taxonomist, topographer, like fingerprints, faces, organic snowflakes, they are never the same. Not one is like another. He names Greta's fan and gold and corn silk, Maureen's pinwheel and copper and fur, and Rachel's mohawk and chestnut and shag. Sushi has her crest and jet and bristles. Nubia's wings are an anthracite and waves. Francois has discovered semaphore secrets in eyebrows. Frida would have undone him. And Brooke, Christiane, and all Persians. He dreams under their dresses. Once upon a time, there was a woman who braided hers behind her back. Once upon a time, there was a woman who sold hers to a wig maker. And through Nefertiti's diaphanous gown, sable and perfumed Spanish moss, God's beard, a nest and hive for swarms of bees and butterflies. Once he hired a woman in whose loam he buried himself, whose fingers made furrows through her field on Venus's little mountain, never harvested. His Paraclete, his Virgil, she led him around inside her Mobius, inside, outside, the same, never divided. Once he swam with schools of antibodies through bloodstreams, gave his lungs to leaves to breathe their flaming tips out into the sun, grew gills, swam the bottom of Mariana Trench, found an updraft on still wings past the sun, and swam with blue whales among the Pleiades. Once. She rises from the tub, raven pelt streaming from its forks. Francois Leroy McPherson is waiting for the tide to turn. She looks through the keyhole into his eye. She smiles. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you.